Oddly enough, he never fired me. He never caught you. Or probably he heard so much about you, he never believed any of it. Even I can't believe everything I've heard about you. None of it is true. I was there that morning they found you under the cafeteria counter, and I hadn't had breakfast. Sorry. So whoever stuck the scissors into noble old Walter March was inspired. Did you? I'd be pleased to be accused. You probably will be. You fit into the category of people who had a motive. He took a child away from you. Were you here this morning? Yes. You had the opportunity to kill him? Well, I suppose so. Lydia said the door to the suite was open when she found him. Anyone could have walked in and scissored him. What else do you know about the murder, Crystal? That it's going to be the best reported crime in history. There are more star reporters at Hendricks Plantation at this moment than have ever been gathered under one roof before. In fact, I suspect more are showing up unexpectedly simply because of the murder. Do you realize what it would be worth to a person's career to scoop the murder of Walter March with all this competition around? Yeah. It would be worth more than a handful of Pulitzer Prizes. Whose scissors was it, do you know? Someone took it from the hotel desk, the reception desk. Oh. You thought you had the murder solved already, eh, Fletcher? Well, I was thinking. Not many people carry scissors with them when they travel, at least ones big enough to stab someone. And anyone who would carry scissors that big most likely would be a woman. Fletcher, you must get rid of this chauvinism of yours. I've talked to you before about this. It's a moot point now anyway if the scissors came from the hotel desk where anybody could palm them. Anyway, Crystal said, it's hilarious. All the reporters are running around pumping everybody. The switchboard is all jammed up with outgoing calls. I doubt there's a keyhole in the whole hotel without an ear to it. Yeah, Fletch said, funny. You go have your rub, Sybarite. Will I see you at the welcoming cocktail party? You bet, Fletch said. I wouldn't miss it for all the juleps in Virginia. You'll be able to recognize me, Crystal said. I'll be wearing my fat. Chapter 7. Another one, the masseuse said. Fletch was lying on his back on the massage table. She was working on the muscles in his right leg. He had been told he would have to wait more than an hour for the masseur to be free. The masseuse was a big blonde in her 50s. She looked Scandinavian, but her name was Mrs. Leary. He had waited until she was finished with his right arm before mentioning Walter March. His question was, did Walter March come in for a massage last night? The masseuse said, I'm beginning to understand just how you reporters operate, how you get what you write. What do you call them? Sources. Sources for what you write. You're always quoting some big expert or other. Sources. Huh. Now I see you all just rush to some little old lady rubbing bones in the basement and ask her about everything. I'm no expert, mister, on anything, and I'm no source. Fletch looked down the length of himself at the muscles in her arms. Experts, he said, are the sources of opinions. People are the sources of facts. Ugh. She dug her fingers into his thigh. Well, I'm no source of either facts or opinions. I'll tell you one thing, I've never been so busy. You're the 9th reporter I've massaged today, every one of them wanting me to talk about Mr. March. I suppose I should make something up, satisfy everybody. It's good for business. But I'm near wore out. Having worked for him, Fletch knew Walter March had massages frequently. Apparently, at least 8 other reporters knew that, too. If you want a massage, I'll give you a massage. She took her hands off him and looked up and down his body. If you want me to talk, I'll talk. I'll just charge you for the massage, either way. Fletch looked into a corner of the ceiling. He said, I tip. Okay. Her fingers went into his leg again. Your body don't look like the other reporters. Fletch said, Walter March. He had a good body. Very good body for an old gentleman. Slim. Good skin tone. You know what I mean. You mean you massaged him? Sure. Not the masseur? What's surprising about that? I'm rubbing you. Walter March was sort of puritanical. What's that got to do with it? She was working her way up his left leg. Fletch said, Oh, boy. That feel good? Fletch said, Life is hard. Walter March was a pretty important man. Yes. He ran a newspaper or something? He owned a lot of them. He was very courteous, she said. Courtly. Tipped good. I've got it about the tip, Fletch said. She finished his left arm. Suspending her breasts over his face, she rubbed his stomach and chest muscles vigorously. Oh, God, he said. What? These are not ideal working conditions. I'm the one who's doing the work. Turn over. Face down, nose in the massage table's nose hole, Fletch said, Walter March. He couldn't get himself up to asking specific questions in a sequence. He blew the bunched-up sheet away from his mouth. Tell me what you told the 8 other reporters. I didn't tell them much. Not much to tell. She lifted his lower left leg and, with a tight grip, was running her hand up his calf muscle. Oi, he said. Are you Jewish? Everyone who's being tortured is Jewish. Mr. March said, nice day. He said he loved being in Virginia. He said they'd had nice weather the last few days in Washington, too. He said he wanted a firm rub, like you, with oil. Not so firm, Fletch said. She was doing the same thing to his right calf muscles. Not so firm. He asked if I was Swedish. I said I came from Pittsburgh. He asked how come I'd become a masseuse. I said my mother taught me. She came from Newfoundland. He asked me what my husband does for a living. I said he works for the town water department. How many kids I have, how many people I massage a day on the average, weekdays and weekends. He asked me the population of the town of Hendricks and if I knew anything about the original Hendricks family. You know, we just talked. Fletch was always surprised when publishers performed automatically and instinctively as reporters. Old Walter March had gotten a hell of a lot of basic information, background material, out of the little old lady rubbing bones in the basement. And, Fletch knew, March had done it for no particular reason, other than to orient himself. Fletch would be doing the same thing if he could keep his brain muscles taut while someone was loosening his leg muscles. She put her fists into his ass cheeks and rotated them vigorously. Then she kneaded them with her thumbs. Oh, oh, Fletch said. You've even got muscle there, she said. So I'm discovering. She began to work on his back. You should be rubbed more often, she said. Keep you loose, relaxed. I've got better ways of keeping loose. He found himself breathing more deeply, evenly. Her thumbs were working up his spinal column. He gave in to the back rub. He had little choice. Finally, when she was done, he sat on the edge of the table. His head swayed. She was washing the oil off her hands. Was Walter March nervous, he asked. Did he seem upset in any way, afraid of anything? Anxious? No. She was drying her hands on a towel. But he should have been. Obviously. That's not what I mean. I had a reporter in here earlier today. I think he could have killed Walter March. What do you mean? He kept swearing at him, calling him dirty names. Instead of asking about Mr. March the way the rest of you did, he kept calling him that so-and-so. Only he didn't say so-and-so. What was his name? I don't know. I suppose I could look up the charge slip. He was a big man, 40-ish, heavy, sideburns and mustache. A northerner, a real angry person. You know, one of those people who are always angry. Big sense of injustice. Oh. And then there was a man in the parking lot yesterday. She put her towel neatly on the rack over the wash basin. When I drove in yesterday morning, he was walking across the parking lot. He came over to me. He asked if I worked here. I thought he was someone looking for a job, you know. He was dressed that way, blue jeans jacket. Tight, curly gray hair, although he wasn't old, skinny body, like the guys who work down at the stables, you know, a horse person. He asked if Walter March had arrived yet. First I'd ever heard of Walter March. His eyes were bloodshot. His jaw muscles were the tightest muscles I'd ever seen. What'd you do? I got away from him. Fletch looked at the big, muscular blonde woman. You mean he frightened you? She said, yes. Did you tell the other reporters about him? No, she said. I guess it takes 9 times being asked the same questions for me to have remembered him. Chapter 8. American Journalism Alliance. Walter March, President. Schedule of events. Hendricks Plantation, Hendricks, Virginia. Monday, 6:30 p.m. Welcoming cocktail party. Amanda Hendricks' room. Hi, Fletch said cheerfully. He had stuck his head around the corner of the hotel's switchboard. Behind him, across the lobby, people were gathering in the Amanda Hendricks room. The telephone operator nearer him said, "You're not supposed to be in here, sir." Both operators looked as startled as rabbits caught in a flashlight beam. "I'm just here to pick up the sheet," he said.
"What sheet?"
He popped his eyes.
"The survey sheet. You're supposed to have it for me."
The further operator had gone back to working the switchboard.
"The sheet for us to take the surveys." "Helen, do you know anything about a survey sheet?"
The other operator said, "Hendricks Plantation, good evening."
"You know," Fletch said, "from information. The sheet that says who's in each room, names and room numbers, for us to take the surveys."
"Oh," the girl said. She looked worriedly at the sheet clipped onto the board in front of her.
"Yeah," Fletch squinted at it. "That's the one."
"But that's mine," she said.
"But you're supposed to have one for me," he said.
She said, "Helen, do we have another one of these sheets?" Helen said, "I'm sorry, sir, that room does not answer." Fletch said, "She has another one."
"But I need mine," the girl said.
"You can Xerox hers."
"We can't leave the switchboard. It's much too busy."
She connected with a flashing light. "Hendricks Plantation, good evening."
"Give me yours," Fletch said.
Helpfully, he slipped it out of its clip. "I'll Xerox it."
"I think the office is locked," she whispered.
"I'll ring, sir." "All you have to do is move Helen's." He reached over and put Helen's information sheet between them, and you can both see it. The operator said,
"I'm sorry, sir, but a cocktail reception is going on here, and I don't think many people are in their rooms."
Helen scowled angrily at him as she said, "The dining room is open for breakfast at 7 o'clock, sir." "Tell me." Fletch was looking at the sheet in his hands. "Lydia March and Walter March Jr. aren't still in the suite Walter March died in this morning, are they?"
"No," the operator said. "They've been moved to suite 12.
"Thanks." Fletch waved the telephone information sheet at them. "Appreciate it."
Chapter 9. 8 p.m., dinner, main dining room. Fletch had sawtoothed seven edges of two credit cards, letting himself into over 20 rooms and suites at Hendricks Plantation before he got caught. He had just placed bug number 22 to the back of the bedside lamp in room 42 and was recrossing the room when he heard a key scratching in the outside of the lock. He turned immediately for the bathroom, but then heard the lock click. An apparent burglar, he stood in the middle of room 42, pretending to be deeply concerned with the telephone information sheet, wondering how he could use it to give some official explanation for his presence in someone else's room. Next to each room number and the occupant's name was the number of the bug he had planted in the room. The door handle was turning. "Ahem," he said to himself. No official frame of mind was occurring to him. "Ahem." The door was being pushed open unnaturally slowly. In the door, swaying, breathing shallowly, thin red hair splaying up from her head, an aquamarine evening gown lopsided on her, was the great White House wire service reporter, Leona Hatch. Watery, glazed eyes took a moment to focus on him. Her right shoulder lurched against the door jamb.
"Oh," she said to the apparent burglar, "thank God you're here."
And she began to fall. Fletch grabbed her before she hit the floor. Dead weight. She was totally unconscious. She reeked of booze. Gently, he put her head on the floor.
"Zowie."
He turned down her bed before carrying her to it and putting her neatly on it. He put on the bedside lamp. She was wearing a tight necklace, a choker he thought might choke her, so he lifted her head and felt around in the 70-odd-years-old woman's thin hair until he found the clasp. He left the necklace on her bedside table. He took off her shoes. Looking at her, he wondered what else he could do to loosen her clothes and realized she was wearing a corset. His fingers confirmed it. Oh, hell. He rolled her onto her side to get at the zipper in the back of her gown.
"Ah,"
Leona Hatch said.
"Ah."
"Don't throw up," he answered with great sincerity. Pulling her gown off her from the bottom, he had to keep returning to the head of the bed and pulling her up towards the pillows by the shoulders, or before the gown was off her, she would have been on the floor. He tossed the gown over a side chair and realized he had to repeat the process with a slip. The corset took great study. In his travels, Fletch had never come across a corset. In fact, he had never come across so many clothes on one person before. "Oh, well," he said, "I suppose you do it for me."
"Ah!"
she protested every time he revolved her to get her corset off.
"Ah!"
"How do I know? Maybe you already have." Finally, he left her in what he supposed was the last level of underclothes, loosened as much as he could manage, and flipped the sheet and blanket over her. "Good night, sweet princess." He turned out the bedside lamp. "Dream sweet dreams, and when you awake, think kindly on the bumptious bandit. Daughter, did you hear the hoofbeats in the night?" He left a light on across the room to orient her when she awoke.
"Father, father, I thought it were the palpitations of my own heart."
Letting himself out, the telephone information sheet firmly in hand, Fletch said, "It were, daughter, booze does that to you." Chapter 10. 9 p.m. Welcoming remarks. Terrorism and television. Addressed by High Litwack. "I was afraid you'd show up," Bob McConnell said. Dinner was half over when Fletch arrived to take his assigned seat at a corner table for six. McConnell, a big man, 40-ish, heavy, with sideburns and a mustache, had been alone at the table with Crystal Fioni and Frederica Arbuthnot. "I knew a table for six, empty except for two girls and myself, was too good to last." "Hi, Bob."
"Hi."
"They put us together," Frederica Arbuthnot said to Fletch. "Isn't that chummy?"
"Chummy."
Fletch glanced at the considerable distance to the head table. "I guess none of us is considered too important," he said. "Another few feet to the right, through that wall, and we could stack our dishes in the dishwasher without leaving the table."
Bob said, "Yeah."
A few years before, Robert McConnell had left his job at a newspaper and spent 10 months as press aide to a presidential candidate. It would have been the chance of a lifetime, except the candidate lost. His newspaper had taken him back, of course, but begrudgingly, and at the same old job. His publisher, Walter March, had considered his mistaken judgment more important than his gained experience. Walter March's judgment hadn't been wrong. He had had his newspapers endorse the other candidate, who had won. And it had taken Robert McConnell the interim years to work himself out of both the emotional and financial depression taking such a chance had caused. Crystal said, "How was your massage, Sybarite?" Bob said, "You had a massage?" To a good reporter, everything was significant. "I was sleepy afterwards," Fletch said.
"I should take massages," Crystal said. "Maybe it would help me get rid of some of this fat."
"Crystal, darling," Fletch said, "you're a bore."
"Me?
All you do is talk about your fat." Because he was late, the waiter placed in front of Fletch, all at one time, the fruit cup, salad, roast beef, potato, peas, cake with strawberry goo poured over the top, and coffee. "You want a drink?" the waiter asked. Fletch said, "I guess not."
"My fat is all anybody ever talks about," Crystal said.
"Only in response to your incessant comments about it." Fletch chewed the pale slices of grapefruit and orange from the fruit cup. "Historic Hendricks Plantation," he said. "Even their fruit cup is antebellum."
"I never, never mention my fat," Crystal said.
Purposely, humorously, she began to fork his salad. "You never talk about anything else." Fletch pulled his roast beef out of her range. "You're like one of these people with a dog or a horse or a boat or a garden or something who never talk about anything but their damn dog, horse, boat, or what else did I say?"
"Garden," said Freddy.
"Garden," said Fletch. "Boring, boring, boring." Crystal was sopping up the salad dressing with a piece of bread.
"It must be defensive."
"Stupid," Fletch said. "You have nothing to be defensive about."
"I'm fat."
"You've got beautiful skin.
Meters and meters of it."
She reached for his dessert. Frederica Arbuthnot said to Robert McConnell, "This is I.M. Fletcher. He gets along well with everybody." "This stupid American idea," Fletch said, "that everybody has to look emaciated." Crystal's voice was muffled through the strawberry goo-topped cake.
"Look who's talking. You're not fat."
"Inside every slim person," Fletch proclaimed, "is a fat person trying to get out."
"Yeah," muttered Freddy,
"but through the mouth?" "If you'd stop telling people you're fat," Fletch declaimed, "no one would notice." Her mouth still full of cake, Crystal looked sideways at Fletch. She could contain herself no longer. She and Fletch both began to laugh and choke and laugh and laugh. With her left hand, Crystal was holding her side. With her right, she was holding her napkin to her face. Not laughing, Frederica Arbuthnot and Robert McConnell were watching them. Crystal began to reach for his coffee. Fletch banged her wrist onto the table.
Leave the coffee?
Crystal nearly rolled out of her chair, laughing. Robert McConnell had signaled the waiter.
Bring drinks all around, will you? We need to catch up with these two.
The waiter scanned the dead glasses on the table and looked inquiringly at Fletch. Bob said,
Fletch?
I don't care.
Bring him a brandy, Bob said. He needs a steadier.
Bring him another dessert, Crystal said. I need it.
Fletch sat back from his plate.
Oh, I can't eat anymore. I've laughed too hard.
He looked at Crystal.
You want it, Crystal?
Sure, she said.
The plate stayed in front of Fletch.
Freddy asked Fletch,
Who were you talking to in your room?
Talking to?
I couldn't help hearing you through the wall.
Hearing me through the wall?
It sounded like you were practicing a speech.
Practicing a speech?
I couldn't hear any other voice.
I was talking to Crystal, Fletch said, on the phone.
No, Freddy shook her head. It sounded recorded. At one point, when I first heard you, you blurted out something, as if the playback volume was too high.
Oh, yeah, I was using a tape recorder. A few notes to myself.
A few notes on what? Bob sat up straight so the waiter could set the drink in front of him.
Aha, Crystal said. The great investigative reporter Irwin Morris Fletcher has discovered who killed Walter March.
Actually, Fletch said, I have.
Who?
Freddy said.
Fletch said,
Robert McConnell.
Across the table, Bob's eyes narrowed.
Freddy looked at Bob.
Motive?
For having his newspapers endorse the opposition, Fletch said a few years back. It snatched the candy apple right out of Bob's mouth, didn't it, Bob?
Robert McConnell's face had gone slightly pale.
If March's newspapers hadn't endorsed the opposition, Bob's man probably would have won. Bob would have gone to the White House. Instead, he ended up back at the same old metal desk in the city room, facing a blank wall with thousands of dollars of personal bank loans outstanding.
Fletch and Bob were staring at each other across the table, Fletch with a small smile.
Freddy was looking from one to the other.
A few notes on what? Bob asked.
Fletch shrugged.
A travel piece. I've been in Italy. By the way, has anyone seen Junior?
Walter March Jr. was the sort at 50 people continued to call Junior.
I hear he's drinking, Crystal said.
Jake Williams took him and Lydia for a car ride.
Bob sat back in his chair, relaxed his shoulders.
He wanted to get them out of here. Get Junior some air.
Freddy said,
You mean the police are making Mrs. March and son stay at this damned convention where Walter March was murdered? How cruel.
I suspect they could do something about it, Bob said, if they want to.
Crystal said, When you have the power of March newspapers behind you, you are apt to be very, very conciliatory to petty authority.
At least openly, Bob said.
At least initially, Fletch said.
Oh, come on, said the lady, who had said she was from Newsworld magazine but didn't appear to know very much.
Newspaper chains aren't very powerful these days.
The three newspaper reporters looked at each other.
March newspapers? Crystal Fione said.
Pretty powerful, Robert McConnell said.
Yeah, Fletch said. They even publish other months of the year.
There was the tinkle of spoon against glass from the head table.
Here it comes, Bob McConnell said. The after-dinner regurgitation, duck.
Fletch turned his chair to face the dais.
Anybody got a cigar? Bob asked. I've always wanted to blow smoke up high Litwack's nose.
Helena Williams was standing at the dais.
Does this thing work? She asked the microphone.
Her amplified voice bounced off the walls.
No, said the audience.
Of course not, said the audience.
Ask it again, Helena, said the audience.
Good evening, said Helena in her best modulated voice.
The audience stopped scraping its chairs and began restraining its smoke coughs.
Despite the tragic circumstances of the death of the president of the American Journalism Alliance's president, Walter March,
she stopped, flustered, took a deep breath, and, in the best game old girl tradition, continued.
It's a pleasure to see you all, and to welcome you to the 49th annual meeting of the American Journalism Alliance's convention. Walter March was to make a welcoming speech at this point, but...
But, Robert McConnell said softly, old Walter's being sent home in a box.
Well, Helena said, of course there's no one who can stand in his place. Instead, let us recognize all that Walter has done, both for the Alliance and for each of us, individually as newspeople over the years.
Yeah, said Robert McConnell.
Yeah, said Crystal Faoni.
And join in a moment of silence.
Hey, Fletch, Bob said in a stage whisper. Got a deck of cards?
There was a moment of quiet muttering. Across the room, Tim Shields was waving at a waiter to bring him a drink.
I'm sure it has nothing to do with the tragic circumstances, Helena said, but the after-dinner speech scheduled for Wednesday evening by the President of the United States has been canceled.
Oh, shucks, Bob looked at Fletch. And here I brought two pairs of scissors.
However, the Vice President has arranged to come.
The administration has decided not to ignore us completely, Crystal Faoni said, just because we've taken to stabbing each other in the back more openly than usual.
Just one other announcement, Helena said, before I introduce High Litwack. Well, why don't I just introduce Virginia State Police Captain Andrew Neal, who has been placed in charge of poor Walter's...
Helena stepped away from the microphone.
A man with salt-and-pepper short hair, a proper military bearing and a tweed jacket, stood up from the table near the main door and walked to the dais. Clearly, he had not expected to be called upon.
Bob McConnell said, I bet you he says last but not least.
With poise, but blushing slightly, Captain Neal addressed the microphone.
Good evening, he said in a soft, deep drawl. Accept my sympathy for the loss of the president of your association.
Accepted, Bob muttered, easily accepted.
First, Captain Neal said, I've asked that your convention not be canceled. I'm sure that the death of Walter March cast a tragic pall over your meeting.
An appalling pall, said Bob.
But I trust you will all be able to go about your business with as little interference as possible from me and the people working with me.
Second, of course, we will have to take statements from those of you who were actually here at Hendricks Plantation this morning at the time of the tragic occurrence.
Your cooperation in being available to us and open with us will be greatly appreciated.
Third, I realize that I'm surrounded here by some of the world's greatest reporters. Frankly, I feel like Daniel in the Den of Lions. I understand that each of you feels the necessity of reporting the story of Walter March's murder to your newspapers and networks, and I will try to be as fair with you as I can. But please understand that I, too, have to do my job. Many of you have already come to me with questions. If I do nothing but answer your questions, I won't be doing my job, which is to investigate this tragedy. And there won't be any answers. As solid facts are developed, I will see that you get them. It would help if there were no rumor or speculation.
Here it comes, Bob said.